The Tom Woods Show, episode 1375.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, there are a lot of people out there who will support you and will buy from you if you accept Bitcoin. But if you've ever wanted to accept payment in Bitcoin and were afraid that it would just be too complicated to figure out and set up, well, I have the solution, a free video series I've assembled that walks you through the process step by step and makes it really easy. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Bitcoin. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. This episode has two parts to it, totally unrelated to each other. The first part has to do with a really important moment in libertarian publishing history that's about to take place. So hang on for that. Some of you may know about it already, but I'm going to fill in some details that you can't possibly know and you're going to hear about only here. Secondly, we're going to welcome back for a brief visit our friend Jose Nino, who's got a great new ebook on guns and gun control and myths surrounding them. And I thought you guys might be interested in that. So we'll say a brief hello to Jose Nino once again. But first, let me tell you about what's going on. First of all, I do have some new listeners always. So some of these folks may not know about who Murray Rothbard was. So I'll just say Rothbard is one of the great influences of this podcast. 1926 to 1995 were the years of his birth and death. He was so prolific, you almost can't believe it. When you look at how many books he wrote, how many articles he wrote, his private correspondence is astonishing in itself. All the things he did, he edited academic journals, he edited popular publications. It just boggles the mind. And he wrote across a diverse array of disciplines and yet was an expert in them. So there was, he knew everything there was to know basically about economics. That's legitimate to say that. He knew everything there was to know. And you can see that by looking at his book, Man, Economy, and State, and just looking at the footnotes. He knew all the mainstream literature. He was not just isolated reading Austrian economics. He was very engaged with what the mainstream was talking about. So he was an extraordinary engine of productivity and endless curiosity and willing to learn from anyone. You know, and so his opponents today, who are so loud and obnoxious, who won't learn anything from him, are the exact opposite of Rothbard, who was willing to learn from somebody who might disagree with him 98% of the time. But doggone it, if that person was good on the 2%, Rothbard was ready to sit and take notes. You know, just the attitude we should have, but which is so rare in this world today and so rare among some libertarians even. So that's why we hold him in such high regard. He did such extraordinarily important work. And he was tying it all together. He was building something. He was building an intellectually fulfilled libertarian movement. That's what he was doing in his work. So that meant foundational works in economics, history, and philosophy for starters. Now, you may also know that one of his projects was a history of the United States. But as with his history of economic thought, what began as a manageable history of the topic became a sprawling multi-volume study when he realized how much there was to report on, to correct, and so on. So what we've had, instead of a full-blown history of the United States, is the four-volume Conceived in Liberty series, which takes the story through the colonial period. So you have all of colonial America in the Conceived in Liberty volumes. Now, you can find other U.S. history that Rothbard wrote, just that we never got the full-blown textbook from beginning to end. But for example, his work on the Great Depression is obviously a work of American history. He did some really good monetary history of the United States that was collected into a volume by the Mises Institute because he published it in all different sources. And in fact, one of my memories of Rothbard was we were at a conference together and I asked him, could he recommend to me a book on banking and monetary history of the United States from a pro-gold standard perspective. And he couldn't really think of one, but he said there's some good material in the Minority Report of the U.S. Gold Commission. So I thought, well, of all possible answers, right? Well, so they turns out they did actually publish that as a book called The Case for Gold. It was, I guess Reagan had set up a commission, and it was one of these commissions that sort of doomed to failure from the start. But the minority report that claimed that we ought to go back on the classical gold standard was, you know, obviously had Ron Paul as one of the congressmen. So they wrote up their report, and their report had a lot of history in it. And the 19th century portion of that, which I believe is now in the Rothbard book that the Mises Institute put together, assembling all of Rothbard's materials, called A History of Money and Banking in the United States. The subtitle is, let me see, I've got it right here, The Colonial Era to World War II. I'm pretty sure it's in there. But anyway, so Rothbard's telling me, yeah, you should read that material on the 19th century in the U.S. Gold Commission report. So I found a copy of that, and I read it. And I thought, wow, this is just unbelievable. I've never read anything like this before. Only later did I find out Rothbard wrote all that. But he didn't tell me. It would have been the easiest thing in the world, and I would not have thought less of him. I wouldn't have thought he was an ego case if he had said, by the way, I wrote that. I was a contributor to that. He never told me. He is acknowledged in the acknowledgments of the report, but there's no other indication that he wrote it. But I found out later that he wrote that material. So my point is, there's plenty of other good American history that Rothbard did. He did a great analysis of the economy in World War I, of the intellectuals and their role in pushing the U.S. into World War I, or what they hoped to get out of American involvement in World War I, namely a more vigorous federal government. Again, he did a lot of stuff. We never got the full textbook. That's my point. So this has been a long tangent here. So anyway, there was a lost fifth volume of Conceived in Liberty. And by lost, I don't mean that it was literally lost, that nobody could find it, but lost as in would never see the light of day, lost. And the reason for that is that Rothbard wrote out Volume 5 in longhand, and nobody could read his handwriting. So the idea was he was going to use a dictating machine, dictate what he had written, and then his wife would use that recording to type up the manuscript. But when he recorded the whole thing, anyway, it came out basically unusable. So even though they tried everything, they could not fix it. And Rothbard was just, you know, as you can understand, very annoyed by this. So he put the whole project aside, and he figured he would get back to it at some point, but he never did. So meanwhile, he leaves all his books and papers to the Mises Institute. But if you've ever seen Rothbard's handwriting, probably you haven't, it's just indecipherable. It is indecipherable. So it just seemed like this is an insuperable obstacle to ever getting this book published. We can't read what this guy wrote. And at the Mises Institute, where they have a lot of Rothbard's own books in the library there, you can see Rothbard's marginalia in a lot of classic books, and you just wish you could read more of it than you can. You can read a few words here and there, but boy, you just love to know what Rothbard was thinking when he's reading these books. So anyway, we just thought, well, you know, too bad, we're just never going to get this thing. Well, then Patrick Newman, an economics professor whom I've had as a guest on this podcast a couple of times, figured it out. He cracked the code. It's like the Rosetta Stone, basically, for Rothbard's handwriting. He figured it out. He figured out how to decipher it. And so he was able to reconstruct Volume 5 of Conceived in Liberty, which takes the story up through 1791, and therefore through the critical period of the Articles of Confederation, a period, the Confederation government of the 1780s, and into the Constitution, the drafting and ratification of the Constitution. That had been lost. We've got it now. We've got it. Rothbard is coming back, and we're going to read what he intended to release and just never got around to. Now, Rothbard's been releasing books since his death. I mean, there have been Rothbard books. I wrote the foreword to The Betrayal of the American Right, which is almost a memoir of Rothbard's activism and his intellectual development. And it's a tremendous book. And that came out, 10 years ago or more. So there's so much material that people kept finding in his papers that he just keeps producing and producing. So anyway, so Volume 5 is coming out. I just submitted the preface to it. Judge Napolitano is writing the foreword. And I thought I would tell you about that, but then I also want to tell you a little bit about what's in it. and I'm just going to confine myself to one or two things, but when I got my hands on that manuscript, the first thing I did was I looked at the table of contents and I flipped ahead to see how Rothbard dealt with Shay's rebellion, Daniel Shay's. And the reason is it really wasn't until the year 2002 that we really began to understand that episode correctly. And the reason is that in that year, a fellow named Leonard Richards, a professor at University of Massachusetts, wrote a book called Shay's Rebellion, The American Revolution's Final Battle. And in that book, we started to get the true story, because the cartoon story of Shay's Rebellion, and this, by the way, is the story that was spread around by contemporaries at the time, was that Shay's Rebellion was an uprising by impoverished debtors, by the rabble who hated private property or who wanted an equal distribution of property or all these things. These sorts of things were said. And what happened in 2002 with the release of Richards' book was that we had a historian now who went back and looked at some very important records. Most of the time when there's a political rebellion, you don't have a lot of records as to who the participants were, because normally you want to keep yourself as anonymous as possible for the obvious purpose of self-preservation. But Shay's Rebellion was different. After the rebellion was over, participants were required to sign a loyalty oath that was kept on record. And Richards figured this out. He realized that these loyalty oaths had been signed. So then his question was, where are they? And it turns out they were pretty much right in his backyard, practically. I mean, he had almost immediate access to them. So he went and looked, because this way he was able to cross-check these people against other records to find out who they were, where they lived, what neighborhoods they came from, how wealthy they were, and whether or not they were in debt. Because there were plenty of wealthy people who participated in Shay's Rebellion, and that didn't conform to the traditional explanation. And by the way, it matters. This whole thing matters a lot, because at the time, George Washington was being told that there's a rebellion going on of the rabble against men of property, and you need to get back into public life to help create a more vigorous central government to be able to put down uprisings by the rabble like this and protect people of property. And there are a lot of people who feel like the gravitas that George Washington was able to bring to the convention really helped propel it forward and make the whole project a success. So the interpretation of Shay's Rebellion matters a lot, because the thinking was if we had a more vigorous central government, we could put down rebellions like this and we wouldn't have to worry about the rabble rising up with their anti-property schemes. So it matters that this was gotten wrong and that George Washington was misled, for example, by Henry Knox, who misled him. So what Richards finds is these people are not indebted farmers trying to go after their creditors. This was a tax revolt. This was primarily a tax revolt. All right, so that's fascinating in itself, that it took this long for us to figure that out. So I wanted to know, what back in the 1970s when Rothbard was writing, what did he think about Shay's Rebellion? He could not have known. He did not have access to the records, or he wasn't aware of the records that Leonard Richards had. So what did he think? And here's what astonished me. Rothbard's treatment, he says, Shay's Rebellion was a tax revolt. He intuited the fundamental meaning and significance of Shay's Rebellion even without the unfair advantage Leonard Richards wound up getting. I'm saying unfair advantage, tongue-in-cheek, of course. But somehow, Rothbard got it. And he even said, look, there are wealthy people participating in this. There's the cartoonish story of, oh, these debtors were fighting against, I don't buy it. And he looked closely, and he said, for the most part, the program of the Shaysites was a libertarian one. So he was not going to go along with this cartoonish, oh, it's debtors rising up against their creditors. This is almost always a smokescreen for something else. So I was astonished at that. Rothbard had gotten it right. A quarter century before Leonard Richards did. Now, that's just astonishing. That's amazing. Then, likewise, he doesn't, unfortunately, get, because he never really finished the project. This could have gone on to the present day, remember, this project. He never finished it, but so he doesn't get to the debate over the National Bank in 1791, but he does get to the Bank of North America, which was another bank before that, and the debate about that. And he points out there something that he also points out in his 19th century history that was published in the report of the U.S. Gold Commission, which is that historians are really bad on trying to explain what the debate over the different banks was, because almost none of them have read any of the treatises by, let's say, a William Gouge or a William Leggett, who was an editorial writer and wrote editorials about it, or, for that matter, William Graham Sumner, who wrote some really great material on this sort of stuff. In fact, I think I gave a talk on the three Williams. Those are the three Williams, who were contemporaries, who wrote in the 19th century. And you can see these people were hard money. They wanted the separation of money and state and separation of banking and state. And the way they get portrayed in the standard tale is that they were stupid, backward agrarians who just didn't understand banks or were opposed to banking per se. What? They were not opposed to banking per se. They were opposed to inflationist banks that enjoyed special privileges that made it easier for them to inflate, because this, they believed, led to the business cycle. I mean, yes, they had an inchoate understanding of the business cycle and its causes in the 19th century. So these were proto-libertarian, proto-Austrian analysts who were against these banks. But given that most historians have no knowledge of this and no curiosity about it, the way it's portrayed is, if they supported banks, they were capitalists. And if they didn't, they weren't. Why do they say, but because banks involve money and capitalists use money? I mean, this is about the level of analysis you're getting. Very embarrassing. No, it's that there were some people who wanted banks that had special privilege, that they thought they could borrow from cheaply. And there were other people who wanted sound money. That's the real debate. And so Rothbard at one point slams historian Bray Hammond for not even looking at the economic arguments and just looking at the political arguments and saying, oh, well, these were agrarians who just didn't like banks or something. What is wrong with you? So anyway, so Rothbard is performing such an important service in this book, and I'm just thrilled that it's seeing the light of day. So watch for it. I'll certainly mention it on the show when it becomes available. But of course, to have the opportunity to write the preface to that book is a great honor, and I just couldn't be more delighted. All right, that's the end of part one of episode 1375. Before we bring on Jose Nino, first a note of thanks to everybody who shares these episodes. If you have libertarian friends, please tell them about the Tom Woods Show. They have plenty of stuff to catch up on and listen to, but I'm producing an episode every single weekday and have been doing so for 5.5 years. So there's no shortage of material coming out, and I always like it to be meaty, not just me rambling, but to be really full of substance. Because I could ramble for 4 hours if you want, but that, you wouldn't get anything out of that. I want it to be substance. I want it to be stuff you can use and debate. So that's what I'm trying to produce here. So again, I see people on social media sharing the episodes, and I can't always thank them. So just take this as a big, big thank you. And do please help me spread the word about the show. I was looking at the some of the download numbers, and what surprised me was the episode I did on the court packing scheme that the Democrats are proposing. I thought a lot of people would find that interesting, and yet that one is not being listened to as much, number 1366. But that is not just a review of current events. That's a lot of history in there. I go through the history behind the Supreme Court, how many members it has, and then I talk about Franklin Roosevelt and his court packing plan and what ended up happening with that. So there's some very relevant history in episode 1366. So don't skip that one. Go back to tomwoods.com/1366 and make sure and listen. All right, let's talk to our friend Jose Nino, who is a prolific libertarian writer. You can read him in a number of outlets. And he has just released an ebook called The 10 Myths of Gun Control, Debunking the Fake News Media's Lies About Guns. Jose, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You have produced an ebook, so you are doing good, my friend. That's a good job. And it's an ebook on a topic that is of great interest to a lot of people, highly controversial, where there's a lot of misinformation. So, you know, you've done a good job. It's important, and I like it. And it's laid out nicely. I mean, everything about it I like. You've got in here 10 myths. Of those 10 myths, what would you say, just based on your own experience, seems to be the most widely held among the public?
I would say the biggest myth has to do with the idea that liberalized gun laws will just lead to massive rampages and blood running down the street. This ties into a point that I make in my book as well, that the whole Wild West talking point not only is actually a historical myth, but it's also just a myth in recent times as well, because we've seen a number of states that have actually liberalized gun laws to a large extent by accepting permitless constitutional carry, where any law-abiding citizen can carry a firearm without a permit. And even with these laws on the books, crime rates have continued to drop, incidents of gun accidents have dropped, and across the board, you see a lot of stability. And I make a point in this book that narratives from our talking points to the history, as far as like the so-called Wild West, are very important to understand and also ultimately control, because when we let our enemies dictate the terms of the debate and distort also the terms of the debate, we open up a wide array of opportunities for them to exploit and confuse the public into accepting more government control.
You know, I personally think that I think you're probably right about that first myth, but I think the second most widespread myth involves comparing the U.S. to other countries, because this is done not just in gun control, but of course with healthcare. We hear other countries are way ahead of us with that. Other countries are way ahead of us with paid family leave, for example. And it's just assumed that the U.S. position must be stupid or backward, and there's nothing to be said for it. So likewise, they say the same thing about guns. They say, in the U.S., we have gun laws that are very liberal in that we have widespread gun ownership. Other countries don't, and they seem to be doing better. What's the truth of the matter here?
Yes, I do cover this in my book. Not to like fully spill the beans, but I'll give a sneak preview. I do cover Australia and the United Kingdom, which are the common examples that are used by gun control activists to justify massive gun control. Indeed, these countries do feature very strict gun laws, but there's one problem. Low crime rates in general have been a macro trend across the West over the past 60 years. You've seen this across the board, irrespective of what gun control laws are on the books. And in the Australian case, crime rates were already dropping way before their 1996 National Firearms Agreement legislation was passed. So you can't just say that gun control was the main factor of why like homicides dropped, because they were already dropping. And to that end, you have to look at a whole other array of factors such as social trust, demographics, and other type of variables in place. Because in the U.S.'s case, the U.S. has taken the opposite approach by actually liberalizing gun laws in a lot of states through right to carry laws, and in some cases, constitutional carry. So there's just a lot of variables in play. And for U.K., they also, in the past three decades, have really tightened up gun control, but now they've had a lot of issues with very misguided mass migration policies, coupled with their very generous welfare state that has created immigrant ghettos there. And as a result, there has been large increases in crime, and the population is disarmed. And even with the gun control in an island nation like the United Kingdom, criminals have just turned to knives and other tools to carry out their crimes. And what the evidence has shown is that expanded gun rights do help the most vulnerable in society, specifically minorities and women, who often get overpowered by much stronger assailants who can just rely on brute strength alone to overpower their victims. So the topic of crime in of itself is very nuanced. There's a lot of cultural factors behind it, but I think to say that gun control exclusively contributed to drops in crimes like in Western countries, I think is very misleading and ignores a lot of other more important variables.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that fact about already existing trends, because this is another thing that I've talked about numerous times the state tends to do. There'll be some positive trend that's already in effect that has nothing to do with state involvement. Then the state gets involved, the trend continues, and the state wants to take credit for the trend. This is true. You can think of case after case, whether it's workplace safety or even the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They say, well, this must have been the explanation for why black people and Hispanics enjoyed much more success in employment. But these trends were, maybe it contributed something, but the point is, it isn't the entire explanation, because those trends had been evident in the 1940s, in the 1950s, had already been going on. So naturally, the state wants to take credit for things, because that's part of the propaganda. What about this background checks thing? Because sometimes people who favor gun control will say, look, folks, we're not trying to take your guns away. We're just trying to impose reasonable restrictions. And for heaven's sake, how can a reasonable person be against a simple background check on a potential gun owner? So what do you say to that?
Well, if people want background checks, they can do that through the private sector. There's plenty of alternatives that firearm stores can use and whatnot. But when you get the government involved, there's always a devil in the details. And you look at the history of background checks in the U.S., they're actually not very old as far as policy is concerned at the federal level. The NICS system, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, was enacted in 1993 and did not go into effect until 1998. And as I mentioned before, and I do agree with you, Tom, that there's been a pre-existing trend of lowering crime rates that you can't just say that this is like an essential ingredient for keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. Most criminals will get their firearms from the black market anyways. So what we do see, though, with government intervention is the law of unintended consequences coming back into the picture. And with the current background check system, you have the occurrence of false positives, meaning a individual who goes through a background check, their name is mixed and matched with another criminal that has a similar first and last name or other like contact information, and then they are effectively disbarred from owning a gun. They have to go through all sorts of an appeal process and whatnot. And as these databases get bigger and bigger, the margin of error just becomes wider, and you could see possibly hundreds of thousands of people stripped of their gun rights just because of bureaucratic errors. And that's what happens when we let the government get involved in affairs that should be handled by the market or civil society.
All right, let's pick one more of these, and then I want to go off topic for a minute with you. Let's see. Well, you know what? Let me let you pick one. What's another one of these that you find particularly compelling? Like, our side of it is really strong.
I would say the racist history of gun control. In fact, this is not talked about enough, because the left loves to talk about race. That's just their calling card these days. But when we look at the history of gun control in the United States, it has been used as a tool of racial oppression. And this even goes back to the founding era, because naturally a lot of slave owners were scared of potential slave uprisings because they saw what happened in the Haitian Revolution of the early 1790s. So many states got the ball rolling and made sure to not only disarm slaves, but recently freed slaves and certain freedmen. And the Nat Turner revolt of the 1830s did catalyze a wave of gun control against blacks throughout the Deep South. And then you have the obvious Reconstruction era with the Black Codes, which included gun control on the recently freed slaves, and they were subject to potential lynchings and other abuses from groups like the KKK or the White Leagues in the South. But also, blacks weren't the only ones affected. People tend to forget that the Japanese American internment of the 1940s, which FDR spearheaded, part of the internment process was the confiscation of firearms from these Japanese Americans in order to ensure their peaceful compliance. And to this day, although gun control is not explicitly racist, it does disproportionately hurt minorities who tend to be located in progressive urban centers like, say, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., or Chicago, which have very draconian gun control laws on the books. Thankfully, a lot of people are starting to wake up to this due to the efforts of groups like Black Guns Matter, who have raised awareness on the racist history of gun control. And I think that not mentioning this does do a historical injustice to these traditionally oppressed groups. And I think it's a great way to build up civil society in minority communities and break them free from the welfarist policies that have subjugated them since the New Deal and the Great Society.
I want to switch gears, actually, and ask, because it's been a while since we've talked to you and not everybody's heard you before, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little something of your own personal evolution in your own thought, how it is that you came to be, you know, more or less in the Mises Austro-libertarian orbit. What's your personal story?
Well, I'm kind of like the friendly neighborhood Venezuelan libertarian. I was born in Venezuela. My family had the good fortune of getting out right before Hugo Chavez came to power. Things were already bad going in. I've written about this and I've talked on your show in previous episodes about what's going on in Venezuela. And just a little sneak preview, I do have a Venezuela ebook project coming out soon. Details on that will be discussed in my email list. But I got into this movement basically through figures like Ron Paul and Alex Jones. I really like their constitutionalist limited government message. And then I perused through a lot of the readings of like Lou Rockwell. And to be honest, I consider your book, Tom, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, as a major catalyst of becoming very hardcore into like libertarian philosophy and history. History's always been a big passion of mine. I majored in history at the University of Texas at Austin, and I love looking at historical trends because that they can tell us what's going on and how to avoid certain errors and correct these same errors from the past. And since then, I've been involved with certain liberty groups throughout my university years. And I ended up working for a gun lobby, National Association for Gun Rights, as a copywriter. And now I'm doing more freelancing. I write on a whole array of topics from, like, say, gun rights to stuff on the local and state level on regulation and other stuff. My big focus is decentralization these days. I do like the idea of competing jurisdictions and breaking up bloated nation states. So yeah, with this ebook, this is like my first foray into like kind of like the whole online marketing type of business, which I really enjoy because it does give you a degree of independence and allows people to find new ways of employment that break away from the traditional 9-to-5, 1950s style of just being stuck in a cubicle.
Sounds like somebody's been listening to me on this sort of stuff. Well, one thing I've done to help people get a hold of your ebook is because the link to it is, you know, it's one of those links that would be hard to just say on the air. I created a redirect link. It's not an affiliate link. I'm not getting a cut of the sales or anything, but it's just to make it more convenient for people to find it. And the link is tomwoods.com/gunmyths. And that will take you directly to the 10 Myths of Gun Control by Jose Nino. So tomwoods.com/gunmyths. I will also, of course, link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1375.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Absolutely. I do want to ask, because as you say, you write about a lot of topics. There are a lot of areas that libertarians have to complain about these days. What's so important about guns that is this your first time releasing an ebook?
Yes, the first time. Actually, to give some background, I was ironically not that interested in topic until 2016, whenever I got my first job, like working for this gun lobby. But it turned into a hobby and then like a legitimate passion through just like research and picking up on like certain trends. This ebook, I see it as a stepping stone, actually, because I think that the educational part is very important and it can lead to more high impact type of activity, such as grassroots organization and lobbying, because I think the gun issue is one issue where libertarians can position themselves very well in politics at the local and state level. Constitutional carry already has 16 states in the nation that have the law on the books, and you're seeing massive revolts at the rural level against big city gun control legislatures, like in Colorado, Nevada, Maryland, and Illinois, where rural counties are effectively nullifying state gun control laws. And I think these are very ripe opportunities for libertarians to get involved, build their brands, build organizations, fundraise, and build political networks that can like promote decentralization and like build like liberty machines, if you will. I think that, there's a lot of stuff to complain about. That is correct. The state is massive. It's gotten way out of control, but there are ways to counteract it. We have a lot of technology that our predecessors never had, and we can always fight back. And I think that gun rights is one of those opportunities. There's also a lot of other opportunities like drug reform, civil asset forfeiture at the local and state level. So that's how I kind of came to the realization that our backyards are where we can have like the most impact, like the city council, the state legislature. So I started off with this book as a way to like first get people educated, and then I get them into my email list where I talk about how you can be very effective in your activism and use these type of issues to build up your presence.
Well, very, very good. The link again, tomwoods.com/gunmyths. That's how you can get right to there. And show notes, tomwoods.com/1375. I appreciate your time, Jose, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's a pleasure talking to you.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. Make sure and join me in Tampa for the Florida State Convention of the Libertarian Party. That's May 3rd through the 5th. And you do not have to be a member of the party to attend. There will be talks by me, by Walter Block, Jeff Deist, and other good folks who've been in the libertarian movement a long time. I mean, Walter Block has probably done more scholarly work in libertarianism than, well, I don't know, maybe anybody living. So obviously, normal people are fans of Walter Block, so it's going to be a great event. Details are at tomwoods.com/events. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.